Chapter 12, Polecats, the Stealing of Democracy. The dictionary definition of a polecat is either any of various North American skunks or European weasel-type critter that ejects a fetid fluid when attacked or disturbed. This chapter is about our political equivalent, polecats, that come in a number of weasley shapes and sizes. First, some historical background. More than 60 years after the United States was founded, all men were not equal, no matter what the Declaration of Independence said. Most black people were slaves, counted as 3/5 of a man in the Constitution to boost the populations in southern states and their representation in Congress. In exchange for the representation, southerners also had to pay increased taxes. In order to vote back then, you had to be white, except for brief periods in a few northern states. Male, except in New Jersey, where women voted until 1807, and a landowner, nearly everywhere. There were 26 states at the time. In some places, that meant that only 15% of the population could vote. It's hard to imagine today how small a number of citizens were allowed to the polls. 15%? In 1841, Thomas Dorr, a congressman from Rhode Island, decided this was unfair to the poor and fought to get the law changed. He secretly wrote a new constitution, with some supporters, to try to make all white males over the age of 21 eligible to vote. 6 months later, two separate elections for governor were held and two men were elected. The landowners chose a man named Samuel Ward King, and the other party, known as the People's Charter, chose Thomas Dorr himself. Despite good intentions, he might have been a little too partisan. When Dorr showed up with 3,000 citizens and two beat-up cannons to take the city arsenal from the illegal government, he was arrested and tried for treason. He was pardoned after 2 years in prison. Eventually, the land-owning requirement was dropped in Rhode Island, and the other states followed. So I guess Dorr opened the door, in a way. But even with the enfranchisement of the poor, it took decades to allow everyone else to come to the polls. Women fought for suffrage and finally gained it in 1920, with the passage of the 19th Amendment, but only after staunch resistance. Some who study our history might remember when the Dixiecrats later used literacy tests and poll taxes to keep black Southerners away from the voting booth. In case you think a lot has changed as we've become more enlightened, think again. There are a whole slew of new measures in various states that will likely keep minorities, immigrants, elderly people, students, and ex-cons from their fundamental right to vote in 2012. In a behind-the-scenes move pushed by the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, who, as I mentioned in the Tea Party chapter, are largely funded by the billionaire Koch brothers, no less than 38 states introduced legislation and a dozen approved efforts to keep the wrong people at home on Election Day. Before 2006, not a single state forced voters to produce a government-issued photo ID. But here's what an article in Rolling Stone revealed in September 2011. Kansas and Alabama now require would-be voters to provide proof of citizenship before registering. Florida and Texas made it harder for groups like the League of Women Voters to register new voters. Maine repealed Election Day voter registration, which had been on the books since 1973. 5 states, Florida, Georgia, Ohio, Tennessee, and West Virginia, cut short their early voting periods. Florida and Iowa barred all ex-felons from the polls, disenfranchising thousands of previously eligible voters. States controlled by Republican governors and legislatures, Alabama, Kansas, South Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, and Wisconsin, will require voters to produce a government-issued ID before casting ballots. More than 10% of U.S. citizens lack such identification, and the numbers are even higher among constituencies that traditionally lean Democratic, including 18% of young voters and 25% of African Americans. Bill Clinton described what's happening like this: "There's never been in my lifetime the determined effort to limit the franchise that we see today." Since that article came out, a total of 9 states, including Pennsylvania and Virginia, have passed new voter ID requirements. The measure in Pennsylvania is almost exactly what ALEC drafted up as its model legislation. In 2012, states in which voting rights have been restricted will provide 171 electoral votes, 63% of what is needed to win the presidency, according to the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University Law School. The hypocrisy boggles the brain. After the Supreme Court awarded a false victory to Bush over Al Gore in 2000, W's administration, led by Karl Rove, declared that voter fraud was an enormous and growing problem. Well, that's certainly true when it comes to computerized elections, which we will get to shortly. But a report examining these claims by the Brennan Center said it's more likely that an individual will be struck by lightning than that he will impersonate another voter at the polls. So 2011 was a record-setting year for new legislation. 19 laws and 2 executive actions in 14 states that are dominated by Republicans that is obviously intended to keep more Democrat voters from the polls. Let's take a closer look at some of the shenanigans. Out in Florida, where democracy got creamed in the recount mess of 2000, the Republican legislature passed a law that makes anybody out there registering voters, such as the League of Women Voters and Rock the Vote, hand in registration forms to the State Board of Elections within 48 hours of collecting them, and to comply with a barrage of onerous bureaucratic requirements. The registration law took effect one day after it passed, under an emergency statute designed for an immediate danger to the public health, safety, or welfare. Emergency? There had been 3 arrests for suspected voter fraud in Florida over a 3-year period. Early voting, a strategy that Obama used successfully in 2008, is getting cut back in Florida from 14 to 8 days, and Ohio from 35 to 11 days, and state government-issued photo IDs are being touted since our impartial Supreme Court upheld one such law in Indiana in 2008. Used to be you could use your Social Security card or a bank statement or utility bill. Now in Texas, Governor Rick Perry signed emergency legislation that makes a concealed weapon permit an acceptable ID, but not a student ID. Under a new law in Wisconsin, implemented by coked-up Governor Scott Walker, which a circuit court judge declared was unconstitutional, but his ruling is being appealed, students in Wisconsin wouldn't be able to vote without IDs that show their birthday, current address, signature, and 2-year expiration date. Not a single school of higher education in the whole state requires that. Until this go-around, Wisconsin made it easy for students and was one of the top states with young voter turnout. In South Carolina, in order to get a state ID needed to vote, 178,000 people without one would first be required to pay for a passport or a birth certificate. In the name of stopping voter fraud, nothing like prodding a few more folks to get a phony birth document, eh? The Justice Department, after reviewing the legality of the photo ID cards and also the early voting restrictions, blocked the South Carolina law on photo ID under the Voting Rights Act because it would have significant racial disparities. It's happening in my home state as well. Alex, state chairman from Minnesota, is a state rep named Mary Kiffmeyer. She's also the legislator who wrote a photo ID bill that passed both chambers of our state house last year before Governor Mark Dayton vetoed it. A watchdog group called Take Action Minnesota issued a report early this year that describes how Minnesota's wealthiest finance institutions and their executives, lobbying groups, PACs, and the Chamber of Commerce have been pooling funds together, sharing resources, and in some cases, sharing office suite space in a collective effort that's at least partially responsible for a Republican takeover of the state legislature in 2010. They've set up a mega lobby called MN Forward, which is backing efforts of the ALEC-linked Republicans to get a photo ID requirement on a referendum ballot in November. Prisoners who've done their time are citizens who ought to be allowed to join everyone else at the polls. But 4 states, Kentucky, Virginia, Florida, and Iowa, have laws that permanently disenfranchise anyone convicted of a felony. Alabama, Arizona, Delaware, Mississippi, Nevada, Tennessee, and Wyoming do the same for at least some offenders. 19 other states restore voting rights after somebody completes his or her sentence, including parole and probation. Only 2 states, Maine and Vermont, have no disenfranchisement for felony offenders. No such thing as a reformed crook, I guess, unless your name is Richard Nixon. Charlie Crist, Florida's former Republican governor, restored voting rights to 154,000 ex-cons who'd been jailed for nonviolent crimes. The new Florida governor, Rick Scott, in March 2011, overturned that decision, instantly disenfranchising 97,491 ex-felons and prohibiting another 1.1 million prisoners from being allowed to vote after serving their time. Most of those, as Bill Clinton pointed out, were African Americans or Hispanics who don't customarily go for Republicans. This is especially true, of course, in the South. Some call this the new Jim Crow laws. It's also a means for social control in destroying minority communities. There's been a conscious decision by our government to increase income inequality and to deal with the malcontents by putting them in jail. But think about how much more it costs to incarcerate a young man than to educate him. You could pay tuition at Harvard for the price tag of keeping the same guy behind bars. As far as democracy is concerned, the worst thing in previous elections has been the shift to electronic voting. In Minnesota, we still have the old hand-counted ballots. But paper ballots have become, for the most part, passé now that we're in the digital age. More and more state officials have opted to use computerized technologies to tabulate election results. According to Jonathan D. Simon, executive director for the Election Defense Alliance, as a nation, our votes are counted in virtual secrecy on computer equipment owned, operated, programmed, distributed, and maintained by a few corporations situated squarely and unabashedly at one pole of the political spectrum, the right-leaning pole. Currently, there are three main companies that produce these machines: Premier Election Solutions, Elections Systems and Software, ESNS, and Sequoia Voting Systems. Time and again, the integrity of this computerized equipment has been questioned, and for good reason. The way I see it, they're stealing our democracy one bite-sized piece at a time. Premier Election Solutions was founded in January 2002, which was then part of a larger company called Diebold. The CEO of Diebold was a man named Walden O'Dell, who was later revealed to be one of George W. Bush's most active fundraisers and who had previously expressed his commitment to help deliver the electoral votes of Ohio to President Bush in 2004. ESNS was founded in 1979 as American Information Systems, AIS for short. In the 1996 and 2002 elections, AIS was responsible for tabulating 85% of the votes in the state of Nebraska. Up until 1995, Chuck Hagel served as chairman of AIS. The very next year, Hagel was elected as a Senate Republican and, in 2002, won re-election. While a senator, Hagel never properly disclosed his former relationship with AIS. These are two blatant examples of what at best could be described as a conflict of interest. But generally speaking, there are more subtle and far more nefarious ways to manipulate the outcome of elections tabulated by computerized equipment. Take, for example, the situation in California in 2007. The Secretary of State, Deborah Bowen, a Democrat, withdrew approval for Sequoia Voting Systems after it was found that significant security weaknesses throughout the Sequoia system raised serious questions as to whether the Sequoia software can protect the integrity of elections. To provide more context, consider the following. Under George W. Bush, the Help Americans Vote Act was passed by Congress. HAVA 2002 was called, required by the replacement of punch card and lever-based voting systems, and mandated all states to upgrade their voting machines. Many jurisdictions then opted to computerize their elections. Those three major election tech companies are, for the most part, protected under the notion of proprietary rights via proprietary software. In short, this means that Premier Election Systems, ESNS and Sequoia, are not required to hand over items such as electoral computer codes or any other trade secrets for independent verification, citing issues of copyright and material ownership of technology. This means that the public can't demand or even request that these companies exhibit the tabulations computed on their software for review and certification. The public can demand to see these materials, and in 2008, the state of New Jersey announced plans to send some of the Sequoia voting machines to a pair of Princeton computer science academics. Via email, the powers that be at Sequoia claimed that allowing these academics to examine their machines would, among other things, present an infringement of their intellectual property. In fact, the two academics from Princeton, Edward Felton and Andrew Appel, received threatening emails from Sequoia stating the company will also take appropriate steps to protect against any publication of Sequoia behavior. The state of Georgia has used computerized touchscreen technology for every election since 2002. Back then, Georgia Secretary of State Kathy Cox signed a $54 million contract with Diebold. Ray Cobb, an academic at Kennesaw State University, stated in a deposition given in 2007 that those Diebold machines did not have an independent audit trail, a requirement of Georgia state law at the time. Kathy Cox, no longer in state politics, remains linked to a Diebold Electronic Systems lobbyist, Lewis Massey, who had been Cox's boss when he was Secretary of State. Small world, isn't it? The ES&S voting machines also appear to be prone to many technical difficulties. In 2006, in Sarasota, Florida, the ES&S systems inexplicably lost a full 18,000 votes. In the end, a Republican candidate won the election by just 369 votes. Despite evidence suggesting that ES&S machines are prone to vote flipping, the U.S. Elections Assistance Commission has failed to take any action to decertify the systems. When a special Senate election was held in Massachusetts in 2010, as a result of the death of Edward Kennedy, the assumption was that Democratic candidate Martha Coakley would be a shoo-in for his seat. But Scott Brown, a Republican, ended up winning, thus changing the balance of power in the Senate. What wasn't talked about much at the time was that 97% of the ballots cast in this special election were counted by optical scan equipment manufactured either by ES&S or Diebold. There was no systematic audit of the vote count, no exit polls were performed, and none of the ballots stored in the equipment were allowed to be examined, let alone verified. Based on a lengthy, multi-jurisdictional study conducted by Jonathan D. Simon of the Election Defense Alliance, it seems that in places where the votes were counted by hand, Martha Coakley defeated Scott Brown by a margin of 2.8%. But when the votes were tabulated by computer, unobserved and not subject to outside human scrutiny, Brown defeated Coakley by a margin of 5.2%. According to Simon, we cannot say with 100% certainty that the 97% of votes counted by optical scan equipment were subject to manipulation, but we can fairly ask what evidence exists that they were not. Also in 2010 came stories about vote flipping in Texas. Citing the YouTube clip of a Texas voter named Don Relier, the Brad blog reported that the ES&S touchscreen voting system flipped votes for Governor Rick Perry to candidates of other parties, showing that this kind of manipulation is a bipartisan problem. One of the most damning stories about computers and elections comes from the sworn testimony of Clinton Eugene Curtis. On December 13, 2004, Curtis testified in Ohio regarding the rigging of software during the 2000 elections in Florida. Asked, are there programs that can be secretly used to fix elections? Curtis responded, yes. In October of 2000, I wrote a prototype in Florida that did just that. It would flip the vote 51-49 to whoever you wanted it to go to and whichever race you wanted to win. When the good lawmakers of Ohio asked Curtis why he would write such a program, he blamed his employers, Yang Enterprises International, and also named a Florida lawmaker. That was asked by Tom Feeney. He's now a congressman. At that time, he was a Speaker of the House in Florida. Before Feeney was an elected official, he'd been a lobbyist. U.S. Representative Jerry Nadler continued the questioning. And he was your lobbyist, the lobbyist for your company, and he asked you to design code to rig an election? Curtis, yes. Nadler, while he was Speaker of the Florida House. Curtis, yes. Here's what we know about a guy who might have blown the whistle on an even bigger scale. Michael Connell. He was only 45 when he died in the crash of his private plane not long after the 2008 election. Before that, Connell was president of GovTech Solutions, a company that designed websites and provided various levels of IT support for government and elected officials, mainly from the Republicans. In 2008, Connell was subpoenaed to testify in an Ohio federal court regarding voter fraud in the 2004 presidential election. He was expected to be the star witness. Cliff Arnebeck is the chair of the Legal Affairs Committee of Common Cause Ohio and an attorney for the Alliance of Democracy, who subpoenaed Michael Connell. Arnebeck believes that Connell's plane was sabotaged because he'd been instrumental in rigging the outcome of the Ohio vote for George W. Bush in 2004 and was prepared to talk about it. Ohio was where Bush's victory put him over the top in the Electoral College for a second term. Arnebeck was the lead attorney in a somewhat related case, charging Ken Blackwell, the Ohio Secretary of State, with disenfranchising black voters in the 2004 election. You want to talk cronyism? Just start with Blackwell. In 2000, he'd been Bush's main electoral system advisor during the Florida recount. He also happened to co-chair Bush's re-election committee in Ohio. A report by Congressman John Conyers on what happened there in 2004 set forth massive and unprecedented voter irregularities and anomalies in Ohio, caused by intentional misconduct and illegal behavior, much of it involving Secretary of State J. Kenneth Blackwell. Cliff Arnebeck thinks that a cadre of conservative operatives, under the guidance of Karl Rove, used a network of computers to manipulate the outcome of the race. Connell, the GOP's IT guru, had been working to build a cyber system that could assure permanent control by Republicans of key offices, state and federal. According to Arnebeck, Michael Connell's business was involved in every aspect of this complex conspiracy. Arnebeck harkens back to the spring of 2000, when Bush lost the New Hampshire primary to John McCain, as the main impetus for certain Republicans to use computer technologies for their benefit. That was when Rove went looking for ways to ensure Bush's election to national office, and Connell was their go-to guy. When he appeared ready to come out of the high-tech closet, Rove reportedly first threatened Connell's wife, and then perhaps took another step. I detailed in my book, American Conspiracies, how another computer expert and friend of Connell's, Stephen Spoonamore, described a duplicate control center set up by Connell in 2004. The Republicans used a company in Chattanooga, Tennessee called SmartTech, Incorporated, a backup server that received the Ohio results. These could then be observed and changed using remote access through high-speed internet. Spoonamore said there could have been 20 Republican operatives, and from that point, they could have made a direct hop to the White House. They could have been running this from the war room. So what, if anything, has been done to fix the problems presented by computerized elections? Ever since the term Hanging Chad entered the American political lexicon in 2000, and ever since the passing of the HAVA bill in 2002, which burdens each state with the need to upgrade their election tabulating process, more and more states are going for optical scan, touchscreen computerized technologies for election vote counting and tabulation. In October 2010, according to the USA Today, New York State became the latest to make the switch this year when it replaced lever machines. The verdict is that elections are more accurate, there is less chance that voters will make mistakes, and there are safeguards in case they do. Since then, though, experts at Princeton University, New York University's Brennan Center, Johns Hopkins University, indeed Congress' own Government Accountability Office, have all sounded the alarm that the system is highly vulnerable to outcome-determinative hacking and/or insider manipulation. It seems pretty obvious to me. To get rid of the likelihood of voter fraud hanging over our elections, we've got to outlaw the electronic voting machines and go back to a system where there's a paper trail. Isn't the conflict of interest obvious, with the computer companies and the vote counters being dominated by the Republicans, not to mention all the new voter ID requirements? But give the Democrats enough years in power, and it's a pretty safe bet they'd follow the same pattern. Gotta keep up with the Joneses. Chapter 13, Big Media's Collusion with the Gangs. The loss of liberty in general would soon follow the suppression of the liberty of the press, for it is an essential branch of liberty, so perhaps it is the best preservative of the whole. Even a restraint of the press would have a fatal influence. No nation, ancient or modern, has ever lost the liberty of freely speaking, writing, or publishing their sentiments, but forthwith lost their liberty in general and become slaves. James Alexander, New York Weekly Journal, 1733. Let's start with a look back at what happened to Howard Dean when the Vermont governor was the front-runner for the Democratic nomination in 2004. He was independent, he was tough, and his honest talk was inspiring an army of young people to finally get involved in politics. Besides Dennis Kucinich, Dean was the only candidate that year who opposed the United States invasion of Iraq, thus alienating a vast industry, the military-industrial complex that gorges at the government trough, no matter which gang is in power. Not to mention, of course, the insurance industry, since Dr. Dean was first of all calling for a new approach to health care. The date that sealed his fate was December 1, 2003, when Dean was 20 points ahead in the polls. At that time, he'd raised much more money than any of the other Democrats, although it came primarily from many small donations outside the control of the rich gangsters. But that day was the day Dean went on MSNBC's Hardball with Chris Matthews and said, "We're going to break up the giant media enterprises." Uh-oh, a leading candidate for the presidency talking about re-regulating the communications industry? In what amounted to a declaration of war on the corporations that administer the flow of information in the United States, as blogger David Podvin later put it. This happened to be the same month that my own show on MSNBC got dumped, but more on that in a moment. Within a couple of weeks after his comment, the news divisions of the four major television networks were reporting as fact that Dean was unelectable. The print media echoed the theme. Every major paper in the U.S., New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Los Angeles Times, Boston Globe, Chicago Tribune, and more were touting the same unelectable theme before the year was out. Then came Time and Newsweek, all this despite a Time poll indicating that George W. Bush was only ahead of Dean by 6 points, closer than Al Gore's numbers shortly before the 2000 election, lest we forget he won the popular vote nationwide. So on January 19, 2004, after all the negative coverage, as well as an alliance among the party-line Democrat candidates to get him out of the race with negative ads, Dean finished third in the Iowa caucuses, after which the infamous Dean scream was emitted in front of 3,500 staff and supporters. He'd ended a listing of the early primary states where he could do better by raising his fist and giving out a gleeful yelp, which the cable canines proceeded to play endlessly at us, that bizarre rally incident obviously showing unpresidential and emotionally unstable behavior. Howard Dean, everybody chorused, had self-destructed. Thus, the big media's unified pre-caucus clucking was fully justified. Except here is what CBS News reporter Eric Saltzman, who was traveling with the Dean campaign, wrote soon afterward. What you might not know, because it doesn't play 30 times a day on the cable news channels, is what was happening in the rest of the room. You don't see the visual, and you don't hear the audio. The television crews recording the event plug into an audio source picking up Dean's microphone, not the sound of the room. The cameras focus in to a tight shot of the candidate, not the rest of the room. What you are not hearing is a room with thousands of people screaming and cheering. What you are not seeing are hundreds upon hundreds of American flags waving. What you are not hearing are members of the audience shouting out state names, urging Dean to list more. What you are not seeing is the way Dean supporters were lifted out of their slump by the speech. In a nutshell, you are not seeing that Dean's speech fit the tone of the room. After that, though, Dean's campaign was history. Maybe it's better that the media assassinated him, rather than the powers that be sending out someone with a gun to do the same, which I was very afraid would happen as he was tapping into people's desperate desire for an honest and fearless man in the gangland politics. But to me, this was proof positive. Anything or anyone that the two gangs don't own or can't co-opt, they'll sick their media dogs on to destroy. As I mentioned, The timing was personally interesting. In February 2003, I signed a 3-year contract with MSNBC to host a talk show. Having recently decided not to run again for governor of Minnesota, I was still a pretty hot commodity. The show was originally scheduled for an hour, 4 nights a week. Soon after the deal was made, I was riding with MSNBC's then-president, Eric Sorensen, to start doing preliminary setup of the show out in L.A. Later, what he said came to haunt me. Right after I'd gotten hired, Sorensen told me he'd gotten phone calls from 2 very high-ranking men in Washington. They wanted to know why MSNBC was giving me a national forum, and they clearly weren't pleased about this. I asked Sorensen to name names, but he said he couldn't. They'd told me I'd have complete artistic control, but almost from the get-go, I had to tell the cable network that I hadn't been hired to read off a teleprompter. However, they wanted all the subjects and guests to be handed down from upstairs, and I started having to fight the brass on a daily basis. I wanted to do meat-and-potatoes journalism about things that impact people in the big picture, not tabloid stuff like they were feeding me. Before long, they'd scaled everything back. I'd go on once a week at 5 p.m. on Saturdays, in the worst possible time slot. I still had the second highest-rated news talk show on MSNBC, right after Hardball. I'd completed 5 shows when the network canceled it and bought out my contract that December. And so it goes, as Linda Ellerbe used to say. She got canned, too. You think things have changed since Obama got elected? For starters, how about what's been happening to Representative Ron Paul's campaign in 2012? He hasn't screamed yet, but he sure ought to. When the Washington Post saw fit to include Paul in its series of candidate profiles, the opening paragraph described Paul as not the standard presidential candidate. He lacks the factory-built appearance of Mitt Romney or Rick Perry. He's thin, bony, a bantam rooster. Cock-a-doodle-who? A second Post piece went on to say, consider if Paul had the heftier, more serious bearing of a Romney or a Gingrich. Would he be so easy to dismiss? In the Darwinian world of public perception, it's easy to discount what you hear from someone who looks a little smaller and perhaps a little weaker, especially when his voice tends to spiral into the upper registers. Not enough of a manly man, eh? Or maybe stepping on too many big toes? Maybe another honest and fearless man not playing by gang rules. According to the National Journal, as of last December, Paul is mentioned on air far less frequently than most of his rivals, including Bachman and Texas Governor Rick Perry, both of whom trail him in national and state-level polls. And when pundits talk about him, they frequently do so in a far more negative tone. It is also true, as his campaign has asserted, that Paul gets less time to air his views in debates. Cable news channels, otherwise chomping at the bit, in Jon Stewart's words, are pretending Ron Paul doesn't exist. Even after his strong performances in Iowa and New Hampshire, the Pew Research Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism noted that mainstream media coverage of Paul went back to nearly zero, with less than 5% of all campaign stories focused on him toward the end of January, even as his poll numbers kept rising. It was even worse in Florida, where Paul came in fourth in the primary while up against an almost total blackout of coverage in the state, appearing in less than 1% of print-based media, while Romney got 60% of the attention, Gingrich and Santorum receiving 20% each. Contrast this to how Time magazine crowed about Rick Perry when he first entered the Republican race. When you look at Perry, it's easy to picture him in an old Western. His late arrival in the primary field in August 2011 certainly felt like that moment when the big stranger steps through the swinging saloon doors and all heads pivot and the plinky-plunk piano dies away. The secret of Perry's appeal, Time also said, was that he can cite job creation statistics in Texas that are the envy of the nation's other 49 governors. The secret? Texas' unemployment rate is higher than that of 26 of the 50 states. And it's based on cheap labor, too. But I guess envy comes cheap these days. Not long ago, an interesting unsigned memo from 1970 surfaced at the Richard Nixon Presidential Library. It was titled, A Plan for Putting the GOP on TV News. People are lazy, the 15-page plan began, which is why they got most of their news from TV, where the thinking is done for you. So how about creating a network to provide pro-administration, videotape, hard news actualities to the major cities of the United States? By going more local, you could avoid the prejudices of network news selectors and disseminators. This was back in the day before cable and satellite channels dominated the news airwaves. The thought was heartily endorsed as an excellent idea by Roger Ailes, then a top Republican media consultant. He responded to H.R. Haldeman that he'd like to get the gig, which at the time didn't get off the ground. But after he got fired by the White House, Ailes did start Television News Incorporated, with financing from right-wing beer-monger Joseph Coors, which turned out to be a trial run for the fair and balanced Fox News channel that Ailes founded a quarter century later in 1996. So I guess we have Nixon to thank for helping launch what we have today. Make no waves and keep the status quo afloat. If you buck that tide, you're in deep shit with the media barons. Let's make it clear whom we're talking about. The roster isn't all that big. In fact, the U.S. media landscape is dominated by massive corporations that, through a history of mergers and acquisitions, have concentrated their control over what we see, hear, and read. In many cases, these giant companies are vertically integrated, controlling everything from initial production to final distribution. The Big Six, in fact, control 90% of what we read, watch, or listen to. In 1983, 50 companies had that kind of control. Today, it's 232 media executives who basically run the programming of 277 million Americans. In 2010, the total revenues for the Big Six came to $275.9 billion. The following political data comes from www.opensecrets.org. General Electric, GE, is at the top of the list with revenues of $157 billion, 2009, including 49% ownership in NBC, as well as big shares in Telemundo, Universal Pictures, Focus Features, plus 26 American TV stations and cable networks, including MSNBC, Bravo, and the Sci-Fi Channel. Most recent figures show GE spent more than $26 million on lobbying. Back in 2000, they donated $1.1 million to the Bush campaign. Most recently, Romney has received $37,750 and Obama $30,493 from their Equal Opportunity PAC. When it came out last year that GE paid zero taxes in 2010 on its global profits of $14 billion, NBC didn't mention anything until the Washington Post started questioning. So NBC Nightly News gave GE CEO Jeffrey Immelt a forum. His solution? Immelt says that everyone should pay their fair share of taxes, including GE, and that the corporate tax code needs to be reformed to make it more competitive and eliminate loopholes. Since Immelt happens to head up Obama's Jobs Council, maybe he could ask Barack to raise GE's taxes. That is, unless he's too busy moving the headquarters of GE's 115-year-old X-ray business to China. Since Immelt took over at the helm in 2001, GE has laid off 34,000 workers in the United States and added 25,000 jobs overseas. Walt Disney, $36.3 billion revenues, owns ABC TV, ESPN, Disney Channel, A&E, Lifetime, 277 radio stations, music and book publishing companies and production companies Touchstone, Miramax, Pixar Animation, and Walt Disney Pictures. According to the Center for Political Accountability in Washington, the Disney Company is the worst among big U.S. corporations in terms of political transparency. Disney admitted funneling $3.6 million into state and local campaigns in Florida, home of Disney World, but they aren't really interested in telling you who they're buying off or why. News Corporation, $30.4 billion, owns Fox TV, National Geographic, The Wall Street Journal, New York Post, TV Guide, and publisher HarperCollins, along with production companies including 20th Century Fox, not to mention most of the British and Australian media. The mogul is Rupert Murdoch, Mr. Tabloid himself, and phone hacker extraordinaire. It might surprise you to know that News Corporation recently became an equal opportunity giver. More than $50,000 to gang members on both sides of the aisle in June 2011, $32,500 to Democrats, and $20,000 to Republicans. They're both the same to Murdoch, who managed to avoid $875 million in U.S. taxes in 2010. Time Warner, $25.8 billion, is the biggest media conglomerate on the planet. Its holdings include CNN, HBO, Cinemax, Cartoon Network, TBS, TNT, America Online, MapQuest, MoviePhone, Warner Brothers Pictures, Castle Rock, and New Line Cinema, as well as more than 150 magazines including Time, Sports Illustrated, Fortune, and People. Time Warner ranked 8th among corporations for donating to political gangs in 2008, $624,618, including $64,312 to Obama. Viacom, $13.6 billion, owns MTV, Nickelodeon, VH1, BET, Comedy Central, Paramount Pictures, and more. In the past, 62% of its contributions went to Democrats. The 2012 PACs, $165,500 as of February 2011, had given 43% to Democrats and 56% to Republicans. CBS, $13 billion, owns CBS TV, Showtime, Simon & Schuster Publishers, 30 TV stations, and CBS Radio with its 130 stations. Supposedly, the company has cracked down on its contributions, but the PAC dished out $105,265 for 2012. Clear Channel Communications doesn't rank quite as high as those guys, but it owns more radio stations, 1,200, than anybody else in the country. That's despite a ruling by the Federal Communications Commission, FCC, back in 1995 forbidding any single outfit to own more than 40. But I guess somebody's been looking the other way. Clear Channel's parent company, CC Media Holdings, boasts nearly $6 billion in annual revenue. Its website also says the overall media and entertainment arm reaches 238 million monthly listeners in the United States, while Clear Channel Outdoor operates close to 1 million billboard displays in 45 countries across 5 continents. Nearly 90% of its radio stations feature right-wing content, including syndicating the programs of Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Beck, and Sean Hannity. After 9/11, the Clear Channel brass issued a list of 165 lyrically questionable songs that their stations might not want to play. That included everything recorded by Rage Against the Machine and Knockin' on Heaven's Door by Bob Dylan and Guns N' Roses. Later, they took the Dixie Chicks off their playlists after the ladies said of George W. Bush, "We're ashamed the President of the United States is from Texas." So who do you figure bought Clear Channel in November 2006 after the company announced its plans to go private? Two private equity firms, Thomas H. Lee Partners and Bain Capital Partners, for $18.7 billion. Lest we forget, Bain Capital was the outfit started by Mitt Romney and from which he continues to profit handsomely as a mega stock owner. Can we be that surprised at Rush Limbaugh chanting, "Right on, right on, right on," after Mitt's best speech so far on January 12, 2012? Rush still supported Gingrich, but I guess he was hedging his bets. So there you have it. In case you are still wondering about whether you're getting independent, unbiased, fair and balanced news. But news isn't what makes the execs and the shareholders rich, it's advertising, dummy. According to the Fiscal Times, television advertising accounts for about 60% of all political spending. Between primary races, national and state elections, political advertising is expected to reach $4.9 billion in 2012, a 17% increase from then-record spending in 2008. Private TV companies broadcasting on our so-called public airwaves are expected to bag about $3 billion of that total from political ads this year. Keep in mind, this is all the result of the Citizens United decision opening the door to unlimited corporate spending. BuzzFlash editor Mark Carlin says. What that means is that there is every reason for the mainstream media, particularly television, to underplay issues such as Citizens United. The increased flow of dollars to candidates means more profit for commercial television in election years. Selling democracy to the highest bidder is a lucrative business for the mainstream media. So it's no surprise that the National Association of Broadcasters, NAB, is fighting hard against the new rules proposed by the FCC that would force TV and radio stations to post their public inspection files online. These include the political files, which show how much these outfits are profiting from airtime purchases of political ads. To cite just one example, for only the Florida Republican primary in February, Romney spent $15.6 million and Gingrich $3.3 million on advertising. A group called MapLight has analyzed the campaign contributions made by interest groups representing TV and radio stations that are benefiting financially from these political ads. Members of the Senate, for a six-year period starting in summer 2005, got $2,043,666 from the interest groups, including $383,423 from the NAB and its employees. Members of the U.S. House got $1,495,325 from the same groups, with the NAB throwing in $549,450 of that, just in case anybody was seriously thinking about changing the rules of the game. Once upon a time, broadcasting over public airwaves meant that they had to serve the public interest. But since the gangs believe that they are the public, all the media really serves is gang interest. I know I've already offered quite a few history lessons in this book, but this one I think is quite important. Back in 1735, on the main floor of New York's City Hall, an indictment was filed against John Peter Zenger, a German-born printer and publisher of the newspaper New York Weekly Journal. Zenger stood charged with libelous sedition against New York's colonial governor, William Cosby, after having printed editorials speaking out against the governor's corrupt practices and abuse of power. Zenger had already spent 8 months in jail. After a failed attempt at jury tampering by the governor, the trial went forward. Zenger was called a seditious person and a frequent printer and publisher of false news and seditious libels. Zenger's lawyer, Andrew Hamilton, didn't have a legal leg to stand on. At that time, under British law, the truth could not be used to defend a charge of libel. A person could be convicted of slander or libel, even if what he said was the absolute truth. But Hamilton put forth a powerful defense, saying, "It is natural. It is a privilege. I will go farther. It is a right, which all free men claim that they are entitled to complain when they are hurt. They have a right publicly to remonstrate against the abuses of power in the strongest terms, to put their neighbors upon their guard against the craft or open violence of men in authority, and to assert with courage the sense they have of the blessings of liberty, the value they put on it, and their resolution at all hazards to preserve it as one of the greatest blessings heaven can bestow." The jury returned with a verdict of not guilty for Zenger, followed by shouts of joy from the courtroom. It was the birth of freedom of the press. The press is supposed to critique our political leaders. That's the main reason the Founding Fathers gave us a free press when the very first Congress of the United States debated the Bill of Rights. It's the media's job to help keep politicians honest and their actions transparent. But our media today are accountable to no one except the two gangs they promote and whose interests they serve. It seems that the more arrogant they get, the higher their ratings go. They've got no incentive to report reliable, unbiased news. The profits are just too good. Today's journalists love to portray every story as a battle, because that's what gets the public's attention. Look how often the headlines describe two opposing viewpoints as a war. They did that with me and Ross Perot. "Venturans versus Perobots, Open War in Reform Party" was one headline. Come on, I wasn't at war with a man. We disagreed on some aspects of the Reform Party platform. But instead of debating the merits of each of our positions, which would have been helpful, this reporter chose to make it sound like Perot and I were dukes up in some stupid clash of egos. This is a dangerous game. and the media plays it all the time. In order to create a war, you need two opposing sides, right? So in the name of presenting both sides, they go looking for an opponent. It's almost comical to watch a TV debate and see two people who basically agree look blankly into the cameras, fumbling for strong words against the other. Or two angry pundits who moments earlier were shouting over each other, chatting cozily while the credits are rolling. For the media to present them as mortal enemies spouting no-holds-barred jargon when they're in the same game is disingenuous at best, theater of the absurd at worst. It really is just a game. The two-gang war has become standard practice, but who says there are only two sides to every issue? Who says that every issue even has another side? Not every viewpoint is equal, but when the media go looking to match up every newsworthy figure or issue with an opponent, they can make it seem as though they are. When you pit so-and-so versus such-and-such, as you do in a wrestling ring, it's implied that the two opponents are a fair match, but I'm here to tell you it ain't necessarily so. The media's turning every story into a fight has got to frustrate the hell out of many of our public officials because they can't get their information across without it being twisted into a stupid showdown. Due to this nonsense, the media is ultimately dumbing down the American public because when we're getting it reinforced to us day in and day out that there are only two sides, the Democrats and Republicans, to every story, after a while we start to believe it. We begin to assume that the issues really are as cut and dry as the media tells us. You're either with us or against us. When it comes to politics and choosing our leaders, we stop remembering that there can be many points of view, and they aren't necessarily represented by just a two-party system. We get caught up in paying attention only to those who are wearing gang colors, red or blue, and flashing gang signs. Instead of thinking for ourselves, we wait for all those big, shiny graphics to tell us immediately whose side someone is on. Did you ever consider that this whole fight club, which puts us all into a war zone mentality, might ultimately be serving the interest of the real warmongers? It's a long-established idea that war is good for the economy, at least if you come out a winner like we did in World War II. Not so much when billions get poured into rat-hole wars like Iraq. But somebody is making a financial killing, right? Not just the weapons contractors, but in recent times, the private mercenary forces like Blackwater, now XE. And what are we looking at in 2012? The threat from Iran is rampant among the same big media who trumpeted about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, WMDs, except that phrase seems to have gone out of style, maybe due to the fact that it was a blatant lie. Turn back the clock a moment to 2003. That was when the New York Times did a series of page one stories about Iraq's purported arsenal. One source was an unnamed Iraqi scientist who supposedly led Americans to a supply of material that proved to be the building blocks of illegal weapons which he claimed to have buried. The same person allegedly explained Iraq's ties to Al-Qaeda and its efforts to ship WMDs to Syria. The only problem was, correspondent Judith Miller, who reported this information, never actually interviewed the scientist, and she cleared her copy with the military before publishing the story. Most of the Times exclusives were provided by Ahmed Jalabi, an opponent of Saddam Hussein, whose credibility has since turned out to be almost zero. The Liberal Times was cheerleading for the Bush administration to invade, and there's no doubt about that. Here is one of their top columnists, Thomas Friedman, saying to Charlie Rose, soon after we toppled Saddam, that it was unquestionably worth doing, because we were hitting the terrorist bubble and needed to go over there and take out a very big stick. Friedman went on to say, what they needed to see was American boys and girls going house to house from Basra to Baghdad and basically saying, what part of this sentence don't you understand? You don't think... You know we care about our open society? You think this bubble fantasy we're just going to let it grow? Well, suck on this. That, Charlie, is what this war is about. We could have hit Saudi Arabia. It was part of that bubble. Could have hit Pakistan. We hit Iraq because we could. Wow. A rare bit of gobbledygook insider candor from the can-do crowd. A house-to-house suck on this democracy crusade. That was May 30th, 2003. And you can look that quote up. Brought to you by another of our American chicken hawks, just like Cheney and Bush. Now let's cut to December 21st, 2011, and a Friedman column that bites the bullet while rewriting his own sorry history. Iraq was always a war of choice. As I never bought the argument that Saddam had nukes that had to be taken out, the decision to go to war stemmed for me from a different choice. Could we collaborate with the people of Iraq to change the political trajectory of this pivotal state in the heart of the Arab world and help tilt it and the region onto a democratizing track? But was it a wise choice? My answer is twofold. No and maybe. Sort of, we'll see. No more sucking up for some suckers, I guess, but now, here's Iran. In two articles that both ran on January 15, 2012, the New York Times misled its readers about what was going on with Iran's nuclear program. On the front page was this statement: "The threats from Iran, aimed both at the West and at Israel, combined with a recent assessment by the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, that Iran's nuclear program has a military objective, is becoming an important issue in the American presidential campaign." Well, it turns out the IAEA never did any such assessment. They did raise questions, most of them years old, that outside analysts then challenged. But truth be told, the IAEA report noted that its inspections of Iran's facilities continue to show no diversion of uranium for military purposes, and came to no conclusions like the Times was claiming. End result was the Times changed the web version of its article and removed that paragraph, but never admitted the reporter had been mistaken. Another piece maintained that if the United States and Europe imposed an oil embargo on Iran to head off their development of nukes, Iranian officials had said they'd blockade the Strait of Hormuz. Again, Iran has said repeatedly and emphatically that they are doing no such thing. They do have a right, according to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, to process uranium to levels of peaceful use, as long as they allow IAEA inspections, which is exactly what is happening now. They are enriching uranium to 35% peaceful levels, while 95% is necessary for weaponry. So why the rush to war? The Times wasn't alone in wrongly ballyhooing what the IAEA report had concluded. Here's a quote from Diane Sawyer on ABC World News. And now, a long-dreaded headline about Iran and nuclear weapons. After a decade of debating whether Iran would build one, a UN report says tonight they will, and it has begun. Here is Scott Pelley on CBS Evening News. Iran is on the threshold of being able to build a nuclear bomb. Here was NBC's Today Show. UN reported for the first time Tuesday that Iran is conducting secret tests with the sole purpose of building nuclear weapons. A Washington Post editorial said the IAEA report ought to end serious debate about whether Tehran's program is for peaceful purposes. And on and on. Red alert over Iran's secret nuke program, headlined USA Today. The hype about red alert coming from U.S. Representative Ed Royce, California Republican and chairman of the Congressional Subcommittee on Terrorism, Non-Proliferation, and Trade. Excuse my French, but what the fuck? What's the source behind all the misinformation? It couldn't be the report itself, so could it be somebody pushing for us to do to Iran what we did to Iraq, or worse? Have we learned nothing from that debacle? Does anyone realize that Iran is a much larger and more unified country than Iraq, where our liberation was, of course, so easy and successful? As Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone pointed out, our newspapers and TV stations may blather on 1,000 times a day about attacking Iran and bombing its people, but if even one Iranian talks about fighting back, he is being aggressive and threatening. We can impose sanctions on anyone, but if the sanctioned country embargoes oil shipments to Europe in response, it's being belligerent. Now the American public openly embraces circular thinking like any country that squawks when we threaten to bomb it is a threat that needs to be wiped out. Just to make sure the big media are fully prepared for the next embedded assignment, in February, retired four-star General Barry McCaffrey did a PowerPoint seminar for about 20 NBC execs and producers that got leaked to the news website Salon. It was called Iran, Nukes and Oil, the Gulf Confrontation, where McCaffrey said they will not, under any circumstances, actually be deterred from going nuclear, and Israel has a threat to their survival looming in their very near future. Be prepared, be very prepared, went the message. McCaffrey is still on board at NBC News as an objective analyst. He's also one of the retired generals who've been part of a Pentagon propaganda program for some time, though viewers are never informed about that little nugget. Back in 2009, a New York Times reporter, David Barstow, won a Pulitzer for a two-part series on how the networks utilize these guys. McCaffrey seems to have had his own military-industrial media complex and consistently advocated wartime policies and spending priorities that are in line with his corporate interests. He is held out as a dispassionate expert, not someone who helps companies win contracts related to the wars he discusses on television. Of course, NBC News never mentioned this story, even though anchor Brian Williams reported on other Pulitzers that year. But just in case anybody at the network had second thoughts, McCaffrey pointed out on the last page of his recent presentation, the accompanying chart showed that 78% of Americans have faith in the military, by far the most admired institution in America. But near the bottom was television news at 28%. Subliminal message? Push the Pentagon line, and your faith ratings will go up. So how is coverage of the big political year coming along? Foxily, fair, and balanced? Here's one that takes the cake. The New York Times fessed up in December 2011 concerning a story it ran about Newt Gingrich. The piece had quoted an anonymous senior aide in the Gingrich campaign who elaborately refuted criticisms of Gingrich as untrustworthy and unprincipled made by Romney supporter John Sununu. The envelope, please. The source was actually Mr. Gingrich, who did not want to be identified to avoid the impression he was getting into a fight with the Romney camp. Obviously a trustworthy and principled fellow, not to mention the newspaper reporter involved. Sometimes it gets hard to tell the difference between campaign journalism and campaign advertising. Take the Washington Post profile of Mitt Romney in its series on the Republican candidates last December. It was headlined, "The Problem Solver." Mitt Romney doesn't want to talk about feeling voters' pain. He just wants to get to work relieving it. Reporter Ann Gerhardt went on to inform readers that Romney is Dudley Do-Right in a Kim Kardashian world. He was a man with a prodigious intellect, who has been married to his high school sweetheart for 42 years, donates 10% of his money to his church, a considerable sum, as his self-made fortune is upward of $250 million, and, those close to him say, acts generously, earns the loyalty of his staff, and drives himself relentlessly to get the job done, whatever it is. In service of his overriding philosophy about caring for people, the quote was from Romney's own brother, the candidate's flip-floppery could be interpreted as a flexibility of thinking that might help him burst through warring ideologies in Washington. Funny that they now mentioned flip-flopping is a good thing, while they blasted John Kerry for the very same. Romney, Romney, he's our man. If he can't do it, no one can. Could any propaganda be more blatant? Care we can believe in? In what he's called his former life with the Bain Capital private equity outfit, Romney claims to have helped create over 100,000 new jobs. But when he worked at Bain, as mentioned earlier, he was busy buying up and bankrupting companies while laying off their workers. Mr. Romney's claims about being a job creator would be nonsense, even if he were being honest about the numbers, which he isn't, as columnist Paul Krugman put it. But it cuts both ways in terms of the two gangs. Glenn Greenwald summed things up on Salon. A presidential term is 48 months. That the political media is transfixed by campaign coverage for 18 months every cycle means that a president can wield power with substantially reduced media attention for more than one-third of his term. Thus he, in this case Obama, can wage a blatantly illegal war in Libya for months on end, work to keep U.S. troops in Iraq past his repeatedly touted deadline, scheme to cut Social Security and Medicare as wealth inequality explodes, and thereby please the oligarchical base funding his campaign, use black sites in Somalia to interrogate terrorist suspects, all while his party's chairwoman works literally to destroy internet privacy, all with virtually no attention paid. The media coverage all but ignores even these pretenses of policy positions in lieu of vapid, trite, conventional wisdom horse race coverage. Who will be the next American Idol? Or the last survivor? When it comes to pushing something outside the mainstream, things get a little more than insidious. Consider media coverage of the Tea Party. Of course, the origins of the Tea Party did represent a real populist movement of folks who are angry that the gangster parties were spending billions of dollars bailing out the banksters who got us into this whole financial mess. We've already looked at how it's being bankrolled by the billionaire Koch brothers and their ilk. Once they were co-opted by the Republicans, they became media darlings. We've also seen how the name came straight from a rant by CNBC's Rick Santelli, who was enraged about the home loan modification programs by the Obama White House. "It's time for another Tea Party," the commentator said. Then came the anti-tax protests and the angry citizens denouncing Obama's health care plans at town hall meetings in the summer of 2009. Even though most of the latter gatherings weren't large, the cable news channels religiously covered them. Next up was Scott Brown's surprising victory in the special election for Ted Kennedy's Senate seat, which the New York Times called the coming of age of the Tea Party movement, despite its supporters having nothing much to do with Brown's ascension. The corporate media built up this so-called populist movement like gangbusters. Would that they had been, instead of being bamboozled by some of the richest gangsters of all. Did you see this kind of coverage with the huge anti-war protests before we invaded Iraq? No, those are pretty much greeted with flat-out hostility. But when Sarah Palin came to keynote the Nashville Tea Party Convention in February 2010 with about 600 people in attendance, the press turned out in droves. David Broder of the Washington Post describes Palin's speech as offering pitch-perfect populism. The New York Times' David Carr opined that if her supposedly broad appeal wasn't appreciated enough by the likes of his paper, maybe we deserve the lamestream media label she likes to give us. What the media didn't say much about were the racist signs, Obama's plan, white slavery, and the Confederate flags at a lot of Tea Party events. At the Nashville convention, anti-immigrant spokesman Tom Tancredo said of the 2008 election, "Something really odd happened, mostly because we do not have a civics literacy test before people can vote in this country. People who could not even spell the word vote or say it in English put a committed socialist ideologue in the White House. His name is Barack Hussein Obama." You already know that I'm not a fan of what Obama has done in office, but this is outrageous. The fact is that most people had no idea what the Tea Party really stood for or who was behind it. But the Washington Post assigned a reporter to make sure the movement's covered fully in its pages. Then came the real coup d'etat. In September 2011, CNN teamed up with the Tea Party Express and 100 local Tea Party groups to stage a first-of-its-kind debate among Republican candidates from the site of its 2012 convention in Tampa Bay. Gee, I don't recall any such media event happening with the Occupy Wall Streeters, but the Tea Party movement, according to CNN political director Sam Feast, was a fascinating, diverse grassroots force. So topics for the debate will be tailored for the interests of this political insurgent movement. Nobody saw fit to mention that the former Tea Party Express chairman Mark Williams was a birther, who'd called Obama an Indonesian Muslim turned welfare thug and a racist in chief. After the NAACP complained about Tea Party racism, Williams had posted a satirical letter from We Colored People to Abraham Lincoln, including this sample joke. "How will we coloreds ever get a widescreen TV in every room if non-coloreds get to keep what they earned?" The Express then got kicked out of the National Tea Party Federation and Williams got replaced by a female birther, Amy Kramer, who'd leapt to the defense of a fellow Tea Partier after he sent out racist emails depicting President Obama as a witch doctor. She was still running the Express when CNN partnered up. Coverage of Occupy Wall Street, OWS, is a whole other story. Case in point, Aaron Burnett last fall moved over from CNBC to CNN with a new show called Out Front. She'd gone down there to see those protests for myself. I saw dancing, bongo drums, even a clown. I asked several protesters what it was that they wanted. Now, they did not know. They did know what they don't want. It seems like people want a messiah leader, just like they did when they anointed Barack Obama. So Ms. Burnett tried pointing out to the protesters that taxpayers actually made money on the Wall Street bailout, which is more than a stretch. Duh. The Wall Street giants made out like bandits. The unemployment and foreclosure crises continued, and AIG never paid us back their many billions. This is why OWS is happening, among many other reasons. But Aaron Burnett, in fact, used to work for the same financial companies that profited from the bailouts. Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, and she is engaged to be married to a Citigroup executive. That's why she's the perfect commentator to be interviewing the OWS folks, of course. National Public Radio at first declined to cover the story at all, with then-executive director Dick Meyer explaining, "The recent protests on Wall Street did not involve large numbers of people, prominent people, a great disruption, or an especially clear objective." When the worldwide demonstrations happened on October 15th, the Washington Post directed readers to page A20 for news about protests in more than 900 cities in Europe, Africa, and Asia. One of the paper's columnists, Charles Krauthammer, called our American variety Starbucks-sipping, Levi's-clad, iPhone-clutching protesters who denounce corporate America even as they weep for Steve Jobs. Another one, Richard Cohen, called OWS, above all, a conspiracy to have left-leaning writers make jackasses of themselves by imparting grave and grand meaning to what is little more than a vast sleepover. And this is the same paper that brought us Woodward and Bernstein to uncover Watergate? Of course, both of those guys have since become war-loving neocons. Not to be outfoxed, the New York Times' Gina Belafonte told readers she discovered a default ambassador in a half-naked woman, with a marked likeness to Joni Mitchell and a seemingly even stronger wish to burrow through the space-time continuum and hunker down in 1968. The movement's cause, she went on, was virtually impossible to decipher, with lack of cohesion and its apparent wish to pantomime progressivism rather than practice it knowledgeably. And who knows more about grassroots progressive activism than the Times, after all? If my jaw dropped when Time magazine named the protester its Person of the Year for 2011, I regained composure when I saw who their runner-up was, Republican seer and deficit slasher Paul Ryan from Wisconsin. His tough budget had brought President Obama down from his cloud of happy talk about windmills and high-speed trains to acknowledge that America has a plate full of peas to choke down after its binge at the dessert bar. Yep, $4.3 trillion in budget cuts on social programs, offset by $4.2 trillion in tax cuts, mainly for the top 1%. Let's see, that amounts to maybe a 0.1 reduction in the deficit over the coming years? And the rich get richer. Getting back to where this chapter opened, I've got to hand it to MSNBC, though. They did finally see fit to get rid of Pat Buchanan as a commentator. Here was a man who called for getting control of our borders before Americans of European descent will be a minority in the nation their ancestors created and built. Who blamed the Penn State thing on the states that have sanctioned gay marriage. Who said Poland and the United Kingdom had it coming in World War II for not negotiating with Nazi Germany, where Hitler was an individual of great courage. Where is Glenn Beck now that we really need him? The media's job is to report facts and events. I think they should leave opinions to the op-ed section. It's a principle of journalistic ethics to present a balanced perspective on the stories of the day. Journalists are supposed to go looking for more than one opinion on a given topic. But today's journalists have gotten hung up on the idea that stories are supposed to be balanced like a seesaw, not balanced like a nutritious diet. Imagine the difference in news coverage if reporters followed the nutritious diet idea of a balanced news instead. You'd get a broad spectrum of views from many angles and many voices. If they simply presented a range of views, instead of diametrically opposing the two most strident, within gangster limits among them, they would leave us free to decide for ourselves the validity of each perspective. The news media have no business trying to entertain us. What happened to the sober journalist whose words had gravitas? We're distracted by scandal. It was one thing when it was a truly political scandal. Watergate spanned many breathtaking months with so many players, it took a who's who scorecard to keep up. But it seems that when the Monica Lewinsky mess sucked our hard-earned taxpayer money out of our pockets, it sucked our ability to distinguish between what's important and relevant and what's a distraction on the political landscape right out of our heads. All you have to do is type hand signal and men's room in Google, and up pops Larry Craig. Similarly, Anthony Weiner. Perhaps more seriously, John Edwards. We're too busy listening to moot debates about the president's birth certificate to pay attention to what's really going on. How many people really know what your senator or representative or governor is really up to, if it's not a juicy scandal? We can blame the media for many things, but in the end, we have only ourselves to blame for allowing our media to be dumbed down. We don't live in North Korea, where we would be required to have our televisions modified to receive only state-owned stations. We have a choice. The only reason the media can make a profit off the scandals they generate is that we provide them with an audience. What is the matter with us? Are we so desperate for entertainment that we have to go looking to the evening news for it? We need to take responsibilities for our choices. When we become passive consumers and allow them to do our thinking for us, we've agreed to let them lead us into any opinion they like. If we don't speak up and tell them to knock it off, what's their incentive to stop?